This is Audible.
War is a part of the eternal human condition, sometimes fought for good reason, often not. Either way, there was a cost paid by those asked to fight. The Pacific was Platone's attempt to portray just how dear that cost can be. We were fortunate to have two extraordinary memoirs to ensure that that portrayal was both honest and dramatic. Helmet for My Pillow by Robert Leckie and With the Old Breed at Peleliu in Okinawa by E.B. Sledge. The war in the Pacific was particularly brutish, raw, and elemental, and indisputably necessary. As a consequence, tens of thousands of young Marines, like 21-year-old Robert Leckie from Rutherford, New Jersey, and 19-year-old Eugene Bondurant Sledge from Mobile, Alabama, would battle a most determined enemy in some of the most godforsaken places on Earth. Making Band of Brothers, I became friends with Major Richard Winters, the commanding officer of Easy Company for much of the war. When I told him we were making the Pacific and basing part of it on With the Old Breed, he simply said, "Sledge is a legend." High praise indeed, considering the source. The reason Major Winters considered Sledge a legend was the book you were about to listen to. It is in the mind of many, including me, the finest war memoir ever written. It is written with such clarity, candor, and empathy that those of us untested by combat can begin to understand, while those who have been under fire can't help but recognize. Composed some 30 years after the war from notes he kept surreptitiously while in combat, Sledge initially wrote the book to explain to his family as clearly as he could what war was like. He succeeded so well that his wife, Jean, urged him to publish it. The result is read here by Joe Mazzello, the actor that played Eugene with such heartbreaking honesty for us in the Pacific. Eugene Sledge struggled when he returned from the Pacific, unable to comprehend why he survived unscathed while so many good men didn't. But after witnessing so much destruction and death, Eugene found his ultimate salvation by studying life, becoming a biologist, and teaching botany at a university in Alabama. Speaking for Platone and for Audible, we are proud to bring you this remarkable book. I'm Tom Hanks.
Audible Inc. presents With the Old Breed at Peleliu and Okinawa. Written by E.B. Sledge. Narrated by Joe Mazzello with Mark Vitor. And a bonus introduction read by Tom Hanks.
In memory of Captain Andrew A. Haldane, beloved company commander of K-35, and to the old breed. The deaths ye died I have watched beside, and the lives ye led were mine. Rudyard Kipling. Rifles were high and holy things to them, and they knew 5-inch broadside guns. They talked patronizingly of the war, and were concerned about rations. They were the leathernecks, the old-timers. They were the old breed of American regular, regarding the service as home and war as an occupation. And they transmitted their temper and character and viewpoint to the high-hearted volunteer mass which filled the ranks of the Marine Brigade. The Leathernecks. In Fixed Bayonets by John W. Thomas, Jr. Preface. This book is an account of my World War II experiences in training and in combat with Company K, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division, during the Peleliu and Okinawa campaigns. It is not a history, and it is not my story alone. I have attempted, rather, to be the spokesman for my comrades, who were swept with me into the abyss of war. I hope they will approve my efforts. I began writing this account immediately after Peleliu, while we were in camp rest on Pavuvu Island. I outlined the entire story with detailed notes as soon as I returned to civilian life, and I have written down certain episodes during the years since then. Mentally, I've gone over and over the details of these events, but I haven't been able to draw them all together and write them down until now. I have done extensive research with published and unpublished histories and documents pertaining to my division's role in the Peleliu and Okinawan campaigns. I have been amazed at the vast difference in the perception of events recounted in these narratives as contrasted to my experience on the front line. My Pacific War experiences have haunted me, and it has been a burden to retain this story. But time heals, and the nightmares no longer wake me in a cold sweat with pounding heart and racing pulse. Now I can write the story, painful though it is to do so. In writing it, I am fulfilling an obligation I have long felt to my comrades in the 1st Marine Division, all of whom suffered so much for our country. None came out unscathed. Many gave their lives, many their health, and some their sanity. All who survive will long remember the horror they would rather forget. But they suffered, and they did their duty, so a sheltered homeland can enjoy the peace that was purchased at such a high cost. We owe those Marines a profound debt of gratitude. E.B. Sledge.
Introduction. I owe a large debt to John Keegan, the British military historian, for it was he who first told me about this book. It was in the mid-1980s, and I was searching out testimonies from Second World War combatants for my book, Wartime. "Have you read Sledge?" Keegan asked. I'd not heard of Sledge. His book had appeared a few years before, with little fanfare and minimal critical notice. But Keegan, a sharp-eyed and comprehensive researcher, had found the book and was so impressed as to write later in his book, The Second World War. Among the thousands of soldiers' stories, I am haunted by one from the Pacific War. Keegan found Sledge's account of his experience fighting in the South Pacific to be one of the most arresting documents in war literature. Keegan's haunted is the right word. Listeners to this audiobook will find it hard to forget. And they will not easily brush away its troubling revelations about what the modern world periodically requires its boys to do and to suffer. One cause of this book's distinction is that its author is not an author. Sledge wrote this memoir less for strangers than to tell his own family what his war had been like. It was his wife who persuaded him to submit it to a publisher. The book is devoid of the literary expediencies and suavities that may occasion skepticism or disgust in more artistically self-conscious war memoirs. Sledge is so little an author in the pejorative sense that his eye seems never to wander from his subject to contemplate the literary effect he's creating. His style is like window glass. You don't pause to notice it. You look through it to the actuality it discloses. It is this honesty, simplicity and modesty that gives Sledge's book its extraordinary power. Eugene Bondurant Sledge, Sledgehammer to his later Marine Corps buddies and friends, was born in Mobile, Alabama in 1923. As a child, he was sickly, afflicted first with malaria and then with rheumatic fever, which weakened his heart and confined him to a wheelchair for nearly a year, during which he had to miss school. But he recovered to enter high school in 1938, where he did better in science and history than in algebra. Latin grammar bored him, but he found translating Caesar on Warfare exciting. He liked classes in literature, except when the teacher left the world of solid data and began talking about symbolism and the like. He learned to play the snare drum and joined both the marching band and the school orchestra, and he was attracted more to informal than to organized sports. He especially liked sandlot baseball. "Discipline at home and at school was strict," he remembers, "so I stayed out of trouble." His family lived on the edge of town, and his father, a physician, taught him to shoot and to observe things precisely, and then to describe all I had seen. Sledge read a great deal and learned to revere Washington, Audubon, Daniel Boone, and, of course, Robert E. Lee. His grandfathers on both sides had been Confederate officers. On his father's phonograph, Sledge played Bach, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. He liked pretty girls a lot, but during adolescence he seemed to like riding, hunting, and fishing even more. He was a freshman at a 2-year military college in Alabama when, a year after Pearl Harbor, he decided to enter the Marines, enlisting in a program that guaranteed him a further year of school before he joined. He underwent the dire passage from innocence to experience that he describes here, from 1943 to 1946. When the war was over, he found himself miraculously unwounded, at least in body. He studied business administration at Auburn University without much sense of vocation, and then worked briefly in real estate and insurance before perceiving that his interest in biology and zoology was pointing him toward a quite different career. He returned to Auburn for a master's degree, and then went to the University of Florida for a PhD in zoology. Now a professor of biology specializing in ornithology at the University of Montevallo, Alabama. Sledge lives quietly near the university, which is not far from Birmingham. On the wall of his living room, reports Studs Terkel, who interviewed Sledge for his book, The Good War, there is a plaque, the gift of Sledge's buddies, honoring one extraordinary Marine, and concluding, "God love you, Sledgehammer," a sentiment listeners to this book may want to echo. Sledge still signs his letters, Semper Fidelis. Of course it was the Marines that attracted this high-spirited, patriotic boy, unable to resist the dress-blue trousers, khaki shirt, necktie, and white barracks hat of the recruiting sergeant. But it wasn't long before he became acquainted with the less attractive side of life in the Marines, the ritual humiliations and abuse incident to indoctrination and infantry training. Sledge rapidly toughened physically and mentally, learned to call the ground the deck and a wall a bulkhead, and came to understand that if he didn't kill the Jap would most certainly kill him. As one instructor urged, "Kick him in the balls before he kicks you in yours." He developed new self-confidence as he mastered the use of infantry weapons, with special emphasis on the Marines' favorite, the K-bar knife. While Sledge and his fellow Marines grew tougher, however, they remained innocent, protected by their naive optimism from noticing that the destiny they were preparing for was to be destroyed or maimed. The fact that our lives might end violently or that we might be crippled while we were still boys didn't seem to register. Next, the crowded, smelly troop transport and the questions tugging at Sledge's mind. Would I do my duty or be a coward? Maybe I'd disgrace my outfit by running away. Then came more last-minute training, now on the island of New Caledonia, with ominous emphasis on bayonet and hand-to-hand techniques. Sledge and his buddies were shunted into the 5th Regiment of the 1st Marine Division, replacing people killed and wounded on Guadalcanal and at Cape Gloucester, leaving Sledge proud to be a member of this distinguished unit which fought at Belleau Wood in the First World War and was later to fight in Korea and Vietnam. When Sledge joined, it was recuperating and training on the miserable island of Pavuvu, north of Guadalcanal. Sledge was assigned to the 16mm mortar section of Company K, commanded by Captain Andrew A. Ak-Ak Haldane, remembered by Sledge as the finest and most popular officer I ever knew. On Pavuvu, rumors from the Guadalcanal campaign were numerous, and accounts of Japanese sadism and brutality fueled an attitude of murderous hatred for that enemy, hatred fully reciprocated, the Marines knew, by the Japanese. This mutual hatred, says Sledge, resulted in savage, ferocious fighting with no holds barred. This was not the dispassionate killing seen on other fronts or in other wars. This was a brutish, primitive hatred, as characteristic of the horror of war in the Pacific as the palm trees and the islands. Once, after hearing blood-curdling screams close by at night, Sledge found the next morning that a Japanese soldier had jumped into a Marine foxhole, where the Marine had jammed his stiff forefinger deep into the Japanese soldier's eye socket, killing him in agony. Such, says Sledge, was the physical horror and brutish reality of war for us. Both sides declined to take prisoners, and both sides defiled enemy corpses. Japanese skulls, thoroughly cleansed, became so popular as Marine and Army trophies that collecting them was finally officially forbidden. The next assignment for the 1st Marine Division was the reduction of the Japanese-held island of Peleliu, one of the Palau Island group, some 500 miles east of the Philippines. Many now believe that the invasion of this 6-square-mile island was entirely unnecessary, irrelevant to the winning of the Pacific War. Some believed it at the time, holding that the island could be bypassed safely without its posing any threat to the imminent invasion of the Philippines. Just to be sure, however, Admiral Nimitz decided to neutralize the threat. Sledge and his buddies did so, at a cost of 1,262 dead and 5,274 wounded Marines and 10,000 dead Japanese. The fighting on Peleliu was supposed to last 3 or 4 days. It lasted almost 2 months, from mid-September to November 1944, and it was one of the worst slaughters of Marines in the Pacific, if one of the less well-publicized. Tarawa became better known because it was virtually the first terrible island invasion, and Iwo Jima became famous in part because of Joe Rosenthal's photography. However, the conditions for fighting on Peleliu were about as bad as they could be. The weather was hot and humid, with frequent rain and temperatures rising to 115 degrees. On the fourth day, wrote Robert Martin, a Time magazine correspondent with the Marines, there were as many casualties from heat prostration as from wounds. The island was of coral, with solid coral ridges and mesas in which the Japanese had been excavating caves and passageways for years. They used these for command posts and troop assembly chambers, and they positioned mortars and artillery pieces and machine guns at the entrances, which were often protected by movable steel doors. Although the Marines hopefully carried entrenching shovels, they found it virtually impossible to dig in through the coral, and thus they had to lie largely on the surface under deadly accurate mortar and artillery fire. To hit the jagged coral deck meant cutting and abrading yourself each time, and Marine uniforms and shoes were torn to bits. Because digging the usual toilet cat holes was impossible, excrement was everywhere before the island was secured, its stench blending with the smells of the dead, with the whole hellish scene baked in the hot sun. As Martin reported, Peleliu is a terrible place. Few combat veterans have remembered as well as Sledge the effects of fear, and Sledge knows that the fear is not just of being killed or wounded, it is fear of something even worse. Fear of not being able to take it and exhibiting the symptoms of cowardice to an audience of men who have trusted you. Sledge tells how when his landing craft approaches the beach, the naval gunfire deafening everyone. His fear is of something seldom mentioned in more heroic and bellicose military narratives. I felt that my bladder would surely empty itself and reveal me to be the coward I was. But once ashore and under heavy fire, Sledge forgets himself in his pity for the others. As he looks around and sees Marines being slaughtered, his word for it, he feels simply sick. As he writes, I had tasted the bitterest essence of war, the sight of helpless comrades being slaughtered, and it filled me with disgust. Disgusting as well is his first sight of a Japanese corpse, its viscera displayed and glistening, bespecked with fine coral dust. And when he sees a medical corpsman bending over a boy Marine who just died, he invokes a word that will resonate throughout this book. The word is waste. A blood-soaked battle dressing was on the side of the dead man's neck. His fine, handsome, boyish face was ashen. What a pitiful waste, I thought. He can't be a day over 17 years old. I thanked God his mother couldn't see him. The corpsman held the dead Marine's chin tenderly between the thumb and fingers of his left hand and made the sign of the cross with his right hand. Tears streamed down his dusty, tanned, grief-contorted face while he sobbed quietly. Prayer is Sledge's frequent solace, the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm his favorites. It is, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil," that he recites as his battalion attacks en masse, running across the bare airfield, and he sees Marines everywhere going down, blown up and torn apart by artillery or mangled by machine gun bullets. Sledge can't imagine how he survived this massacre, and he concludes that this murderous dash across several hundred yards under massed fire was his very worst combat experience. Not long after, in a moment of silence during a quiet conversation, he hears, as he says, a loud voice say clearly and distinctly, "You will survive the war." No one in the group has spoken. The voice has been heard by Sledge alone. Perhaps he has come momentarily unhinged, or perhaps the intensity of the unspoken wish to come out alive has skewed his hearing and his understanding. Normally skeptical of visions and ghost stories and the like, Sledge is persuaded that God spoke to him that night. As a result, he says, he resolved, like other infantrymen who have barely escaped death, to make his life amount to something after the war. Astonished and appalled by the unbelievable carnage, Sledge felt he had to make a record of it. Diaries were forbidden, but in a little rubber bag he took from a Japanese body, Sledge carried his small New Testament, and into its pages he slipped tiny sheets of paper covered with notes. His frequent recourse to his testament misled his buddies into imagining him more pious than he was. He was actually, as he says, keeping notes. After some patrolling and night defensive work, during which 1K Company Marine goes noisily mad and becomes quiet only when hit with a shovel, in the morning he turns out to be dead, Sledge's battalion encounters the Army infantrymen of the veteran 81st Division sent to reinforce the Peleliu operation. The popular and amusing animosities between Army and Marines are suddenly laid aside. Things are now too serious for the normal Marine sport of barking at the dog faces, and as a result of common experience, says Sledge, we respected each other completely. Something in me died at Peleliu, Sledge writes. One of the many casualties there is his initial innocence about human evil. Without turning mechanically pessimistic or cynical, Sledge is obliged to complicate and deepen his understanding of human possibility when he watches a fellow Marine use his K-bar knife to extract gold teeth from a wounded but still living Japanese, who kicks and writhes as the Marine goes to work. Frustrated and impatient, the Marine finally eases his task by slicing his prisoner's cheeks ear to ear, which, if it makes him gurgle in his own blood and thrash about, exposes the teeth nicely. Watching this, Sledge learns what every generation would learn if it could see its youth engaged in infantry fighting. As a Marine sergeant told Philip Caputo during the Vietnam War, "Before you leave here, sir, you're going to learn that one of the most brutal things in the world is your average 19-year-old American boy." Of nasty, sadistic episodes like this, Sledge writes, "Such was the incredible cruelty that decent men could commit when reduced to a brutish existence in their fight for survival amid the violent death, terror, tension, fatigue, and filth that was the infantryman's war." He goes on to emphasize that such an understanding of human behavior, obvious to all on the line, was not readily available to those removed only a short distance to the rear. If you are back only a couple of hundred yards behind anger and cruelty and hysteria and fear of death, you are too far back to understand. And that is one of the reasons Sledge has written this book. It is about the mystique, that is the right word, of killing to avoid being killed, torturing to avoid being tortured. At various headquarters, reason may govern, but the line is a place of passion and madness. Sledge uses the words totally incomprehensible, absolute as they are, responsibly when observing that Peleliu made savages of us all, he declares, "We existed in an environment totally incomprehensible to men behind the lines, service troops and civilians." Sledge and his buddies can hardly believe it when, ragged, filthy, and hollow-eyed, they are finally relieved by Army infantry, which required 6 more weeks to end the battle. Sledge's Company K, formerly 235 strong, climbs aboard the departing transport with only 85 survivors, including 2 of the original 7 officers. Back on Pavuvu, there is the shock of re-encountering people innocent of murder and cruelty and fear. a nice Red Cross girl who proffers paper cups of grapefruit juice to men coming off the ship, a new unbloodied second lieutenant whose uniform is too neat and clean and who offends Sledge by calling him Sonny. Back under tents, Company K receives replacements, and before long training resumes and rumors begin to imply there is going to be another rugged campaign soon. News about the carnage then in progress on Iwo Jima suggested that the Japanese were resisting more insanely the nearer the war came to their main islands. Okinawa was very near. As a defensive position, Okinawa was a peleliu 10 times larger. The island was 60 miles long and 18 miles wide at its widest point. It was defended by 110,000 Japanese who had excavated and fortified elaborate caves, tunnels, and casemates concealing a deadly accumulation of artillery. This time, Sledge's battalion was in reserve at first, but it still had to land on the beach at D-Day, April 1, 1945. Climbing down the landing net, Sledge was still frightened, although having been through Peleliu, not as frightened as before. But this time there proved little reason for fright. The landing was virtually unopposed, and the soldiers and marines, a force ultimately numbering 500,000, waded ashore smiling and even singing. To Sledge, it was the most pleasant surprise of the war. The weather the first few days was cool and dry, too, and the deck was not of coral but of eminently diggable dirt. The smell so far was mainly of pine trees. The battle plan was first to attack across the island, cutting it in two, and then for the Marines to attack to the north and the army to the south. Cutting the island in half took only 4 days. Resistance was light and scattered. The seizing of the northern part of the island was not too bad either. The 6th Marine Division did it in 7 days. In the south, however, the army met fantastic resistance, and soon the Marines were called to assist. The 1st Marine Division relieved the badly chewed-up 27th Infantry Division, and Sledge was headed for action again, filled with dread. This time he was on the line, or mortally near it, for 50 days, beginning May 1st with a failed Marine attack on one of the numerous southern ridges, in rain and mud, against terrible fire. The news arriving May 8th that Germany had surrendered did little to raise Marine Corps spirits, for everyone knew that the Japanese on Okinawa would resist until all were killed, and that, as Sledge says, Japan would have to be invaded with the same gruesome prospects. But only a fatuously optimistic Marine could believe he would survive long enough for that horror. Today, almost 50 years later, Sledge still has nightmares about the bloody, muddy month of May in Okinawa, when the artillery fire from both sides was so heavy and unremitting that he had a constant headache. The Japanese were lodged so deeply in their caves that the American artillery hardly bothered them, and when it paused, they resumed their defense with rifles, grenades, mortars, and machine guns, firing at corpsmen and litter-bearers in purposeful contempt for Western civilities. The battlefield was soon scarred, cratered, and treeless, a mess of mud and water-filled holes and slippery ridges, looking like Verdun in the Great War. A week-long stay in a muddy hole on Half Moon Ridge near Shuri, the main Japanese point of resistance, almost drove Sledge insane. There he existed in an atmosphere of unburied, stinking Japanese and Marine corpses, maggots, flies, rain, dysentery, knee-deep mud, and the constant fear of death at any moment. It was the most ghastly corner of hell I had ever witnessed, Sledge writes. Peleliu had been bad, but this was an environment so degrading I believed we had been flung into hell's own cesspool. To slip in the mud and fall was to have one's clothing filled with wriggling maggots from the rotting corpses. And if a Marine slipped and slid down the back slope of the muddy ridge, he was apt to reach the bottom, vomiting. The war for Sledge and the others fighting in conditions like this was insanity, and some Marines went insane, reduced by the shelling to crying or mad shouting and screaming. Others were removed from the line suffering from malaria or pneumonia. Those with trench foot stayed put. The Japanese, finally driven out of their Shuri positions, withdrew further south to a last-stand defense at Kunishi Ridge, where, as usual, they occupied deep caves largely resistant to artillery, aerial bombing, and naval gunfire. Despite hopes for some respite, Sledge's company had to continue with its dreadful work, and sensing that his luck was running out, one can't expect to beat the terrible odds forever, Sledge was in a near panic. But he did not break. When his battalion finally reached the southern shore of the island, Company K was down to 50 men. The reduction of Okinawa had taken 82 days. Private First Class Eugene Sledge had lost 25 pounds, and on his hands and arms were open sores that would not heal for months. But a final indignity. His battalion had to now move north again, burying the blackened Japanese corpses and salvaging brass shell cases. American casualties on Okinawa came to almost 40,000. There were also more than 26,000 neuropsychiatric cases, men evacuated after psychological breakdowns. In addition to the destruction of the Japanese defenders, some 42,000 Okinawan civilians were killed. Knowing all too well what the forthcoming invasion of Japan would mean for them, Sledge and the lucky survivors in his outfit heard the news of the A-bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with an indescribable sense of relief. They would live, even if shaken and illuminated for a lifetime about the depth of human iniquity. Sledge's testimony about these almost incredible events is entirely credible because of his evident decency and his remoteness from any sort of disingenuousness, actual or literary. His way both with life and language is straight, without irony, hyperbole, or the desire to show off. If another writer asserted that in the shower he had seen a longtime member of the old breed, Gunnery Sergeant St. Elmo M. Haney, briskly scrubbing his genital organs with a GI brush, we might disbelieve. When Sledge tells us this, we know it is true. Veterans of front lines everywhere will applaud the accuracy with which Sledge registers the sights and sounds of combat. Authors and screenwriters are likely to assert that bullets whine. Sledge knows that they snap. It is artillery shells that whine, while mortar shells whisper faintly. Also remarkably accurate is Sledge's memory of physical details. He recalls exactly what it's like to hike with a heavy pack in a long column that frequently and inexplicably stops. If a man put down his load, he was sure to hear, "Pick up your gear, we're moving out." When the column paused, each man was faced with what Sledge calls, without irony, a big decision. The big decision in every man's mind at each pause in the column's forward progress was whether to drop his load and hope for a lengthy pause, or to stand there and support all the weight rather than putting it down and having to pick it up again right away. Sledge's precise description and honest narration accommodate without apology or ex post facto self-consciousness his boyish pride in being a Marine and helping to win the war, as well as his natural disdain for those in the rear so unimaginative as not to be able to understand what the line troops go through. He honestly hero-worships his company's skipper, Captain Haldane, and he honestly reports his sobs when he hears that Haldane has been killed, and he still mourns for him after all these years. His sharp eye for evidence of nobility and courage in others prompts him to celebrate the selfless dedication of the corpsman. Sledge's sense of honor obliges him to keep his promises, even apparently trivial ones. His book indicates the way he has been true to his wartime experience. He has not allowed the passage of time or subsequent political history to soften the cruel outlines of an experience he must not euphemize or forget. After 15 days of fighting on Peleliu, Sledge was finally overcome by the strain. "I felt myself choking up. I slowly turned my back to the men facing me as I sat on my helmet and put my face in my hands to try to shut out reality. I began sobbing. My body shuddered and shook." But what occasioned this outburst is less Sledge's own fear than his pity for others. He has just heard of a severely wounded Marine nearby whose body, lifted onto a litter, came apart. I was sickened and revolted to see healthy young men get hurt and killed day after day. I felt I couldn't take any more. It is this extraordinary compassion that makes Sledge so unique a memoirist of war. One expects an infantryman or marine to feel fear and pity for himself, but it is rare for a soldier to be distraught because he feels for others, total strangers often, and to be distraught without a trace of sentimental affectation or secret self-congratulation. For this reason, Sledge doubtless suffered more than many of his fellow Marines, and he has not notably hardened since. "I don't like to watch television shows with violence in them," he says today. A poem he likes to quote comes from the First World War, but he knows it will serve for the Second and subsequent wars as well. It is Wilfred Owen's Insensibility, Owen's ironic celebration of men devoid of compassion and imagination, whose experiences in war are easier and more forgettable than those of their sensitive comrades. "Happy are men who yet before they are killed can let their veins run cold, whom no compassion fleers or makes their feet sore on the alleys cobbled with their brothers. Happy are those who lose imagination. They have enough to carry with ammunition. Happy the soldier home with not a notion how somewhere, every dawn, some men attack. But cursed are dullards whom no cannon stuns. By choice they made themselves immune to pity." If it was Sledge's fine sensibility that caused him to suffer more than some, it is that same sensibility that in this book has kept the distinctions firm, the compassion warm, the imagination agile, and the values admirable. Paul Fussell.
Chapter 4. Assault into Hell. H hour, 0800. Long jets of red flame, mixed with thick black smoke, rushed out of the muzzles of the huge battleship's 16-inch guns with a noise like a thunderclap. The giant shells tore through the air toward the island, roaring like locomotives. "Boy, it must cost a fortune to fire them 16-inch babies," said a buddy near me. "Screw the expense," growled another. Only less impressive were the cruisers firing 8-inch salvos, and the host of smaller ships firing rapid fire. The usually clean, salty air was strong with the odors of explosives and diesel fuel. While the assault waves formed up, and my amphibious tractor lay still in the water, with engines idling, the tempo of the bombardment increased to such an intensity that I couldn't distinguish the reports of the various types of weapons through the thunderous noise. We had to shout at each other to be heard. The big ships increased their fire and moved off to the flanks of the Amtrak formations when we started in, so as not to fire over us at the risk of short rounds. We waited a seeming eternity for the signal to start toward the beach. The suspense was almost more than I could bear. Waiting is a major part of war, but I never experienced any more supremely agonizing suspense than the excruciating torture of those moments before we received the signal to begin the assault on Peleliu. I broke out in a cold sweat as the tension mounted with the intensity of the bombardment. My stomach was tied in knots. I had a lump in my throat and swallowed only with great difficulty. My knees nearly buckled, so I clung weakly to the side of the tractor. I felt nauseated and feared that my bladder would surely empty itself and reveal me to be the coward I was. But the men around me looked just about the way I felt. Finally, with a sense of fatalistic relief mixed with a flash of anger at the Navy officer who was our wave commander, I saw him wave his flag toward the beach. Our driver revved the engine. The treads churned up the water, and we started in, the second wave ashore. We moved ahead, watching the frightful spectacle. Huge geysers of water rose around the Amtraks ahead of us as they approached the reef. The beach was now marked along its length by a continuous sheet of flame, backed by a thick wall of smoke. It seemed as though a huge volcano had erupted from the sea. And rather than heading for an island, we were being drawn into the vortex of a flaming abyss. For many, it was to be oblivion. The lieutenant braced himself and pulled out a half-pint whiskey bottle. "This is it, boys," he yelled. Just like they do in movies, it seemed unreal. He held the bottle out to me, but I refused. Just sniffing the cork under those conditions might have made me pass out. He took a long pull on the bottle, and a couple of the men did the same. Suddenly, a large shell exploded with a terrific concussion, and a huge geyser rose up, just to our right front. It barely missed us. The engine stalled. The front of the tractor lurched to the left, and bumped hard against the rear of another Amtrak that was either stalled or hit. I never knew which. We sat stalled, floating in the water for some terrifying moments. We were sitting ducks for the enemy gunners. I looked forward, through the hatch behind the driver. He was wrestling frantically with the control levers. Japanese shells were screaming into the area and exploding all around us. Sergeant Johnny Marmet leaned toward the driver and yelled something. Whatever it was, it seemed to calm the driver, because he got the engine started. We moved forward again amid the geysers of exploding shells. Our bombardment began to lift off the beach and move inland. Our dive bombers also moved inland with their strafing and bombing. The Japanese increased the volume of their fire against the waves of Amtraks. Above the din, I could hear the ominous sound of shell fragments humming and growling through the air. "Stand by," someone yelled. I picked up my mortar ammo bag and slung it over my left shoulder, buckled my helmet chin strap, adjusted my carbine sling over my right shoulder, and tried to keep my balance. My heart pounded. Our Amtrak came out of the water and moved a few yards up the gentle sloping sand. "Hit the beach!" yelled an NCO moments before the machine lurched to a stop. The men piled over the sides as fast as they could. I followed snafu, climbed up, and planted both feet firmly on the left side so as to leap as far away from it as possible. At that instant, a burst of machine gun fire with white-hot tracers snapped through the air at eye level, almost grazing my face. I pulled my head back like a turtle, lost my balance, and fell awkwardly forward, down onto the sand in a tangle of ammo bag, pack, helmet, carbine, gas mask, cartridge belt, and flopping canteens. "Get off the beach! Get off the beach!" raced through my mind. Once I felt land under my feet, I wasn't as scared as I had been coming across the reef. My legs dug up the sand as I tried to rise. A firm hand gripped my shoulder. "Oh God," I thought. "It's a nip was coming out of his pillbox." I couldn't reach my K-bar, fortunately, because as I got my face out of the sand and looked up, there was the worried face of a Marine bending over me. He thought the machine gun burst had hit me, and he had crawled over to help. When he saw I was unhurt, he spun around and started crawling rapidly off the beach. I scuttled after him. Shells crashed all around. Fragments tore and whirred, slapping on the sand and splashing into the water a few yards behind us. The Japanese were recovering from the shock of our pre-landing bombardment. Their machine gun and rifle fire got thicker, snapping viciously overhead in increasing volume. Our Amtrak spun around and headed back out as I reached the edge of the beach and flattened on the deck. The world was a nightmare of flashes, violent explosions, and snapping bullets. Most of what I saw blurred. My mind was benumbed by the shock of it. I glanced back across the beach and saw Duck W, rubber-tired amphibious truck, roll up on the sand at a point near where we had just landed. The instant the Duck W stopped, it was engulfed in thick, dirty black smoke, as a shell scored a direct hit on it. Bits of debris flew into the air. I watched with that odd, detached fascination, peculiar to men under fire, as a flat metal panel, about 2 feet square, spun high into the air, then splashed into shallow water like a big pancake. I didn't see any men get out of the Duck W. Up and down the beach and out on the reef, a number of Amtraks and Duck W's were burning. Japanese machine gun bursts made long splashes on the water, as though flaying it with some giant whip. The geysers belched up relentlessly where the mortar and artillery shells hit. I caught a fleeting glimpse of a group of Marines leaving a smoking Amtrak on the reef. Some fell as bullets and fragments splashed among them. Their buddies tried to help them as they struggled in the knee-deep water. I shuddered and choked. A wild, desperate feeling of anger, frustration, and pity gripped me. It was an emotion that always would torture my mind when I saw men trapped and was unable to do anything but watch as they were hit. My own plight forgotten momentarily, I felt sickened to the depths of my soul. I asked God, why? Why? I turned my face away and wished that I were imagining it all. I had tasted the bitterest essence of war, the sight of helpless comrades being slaughtered, and it filled me with disgust. I got up, crouching low. I raced up the sloping beach into a defilade. Reaching the inland edge of the sand just beyond the high water mark, I glanced down and saw the nose of a huge black and yellow bomb protruding from the sand. A metal plate attached to the top served as a pressure trigger. My foot had missed it by only inches. I hit the deck again just inside the defilade. On the sand, immediately in front of me, was a dead snake about 18 inches long. It was colorful, somewhat like American species I had kept as pets when a boy. It was the only snake I saw in Peleliu. Momentarily, I was out of the heavy fire hitting on the beach. A strong smell of chemicals and exploding shells filled the air. Patches of coral and sand around me were yellowed from the powder from shell blasts. A large white post, about 4 feet high, stood at the edge of the defilade. Japanese writing was painted on the side facing the beach. To me, it appeared as though a chicken, with muddy feet, had walked up and down the post. I felt a sense of pride that this was enemy territory, and that we were capturing it for our country to help win the war. One of our NCOs signaled us to move to our right, out of the shallow defilade. I was glad, because the Japanese probably would pour mortar fire into it to prevent it from being used for shelter. At the moment, however, the gunners seemed to be concentrating on the beach and the incoming waves of Marines. I ran over to where one of our veterans stood, looking to our front and flopped down at his feet. "You better get down," I yelled, as bullets snapped and cracked all around. "Them slugs are high. They're hitting in the leaves, Sledgehammer," he said nonchalantly without looking at me. "Leaves, hell! Where are the trees?" I yelled back at him. Startled, he looked right and left. Down the beach, barely visible, was a shattered palm. Nothing near us stood over knee-high. He hit the deck. "I must be cracking up, Sledgehammer. Them slugs sound just like they did in the jungle at Gloucester. And I figured they were hitting leaves," he said with chagrin. "Somebody give me a cigarette," I yelled to my squad mates nearby. Snafu was jubilant. "I told you you'd start smoking, didn't I, Sledgehammer?" A buddy handed me a smoke, and with trembling hands, we got it lit. They really kidded me about going back on all my previous refusals to smoke. I kept looking to our right, expecting to see men from the 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, 3-7, which was supposed to be there. But I saw only the familiar faces of Marines from my own company as we moved off the beach. Marines began to come in behind us in increasing numbers, but none were visible on our right flank. Unfamiliar officers and NCOs yelled and shouted orders. "K Company, 1st Platoon, move over here!" Or, "K Company, Mortar Section, over here!" Considerable confusion prevailed for about 15 minutes, as our officers and the leaders of our namesake company in the 7th Marines straightened out the two units.
From left to right along the 2,200-yard beachfront, the 1st Marines, the 5th Marines, and the 7th Marines landed abreast. The 1st Marines landed one battalion on each of the two northern white beaches. In the division center, the 5th Marines landed its 1st Battalion, 1-5, over Orange Beach 1, and its 3rd Battalion, 3-5, over Orange Beach 2. Forming the right flank of the division, the 7th Marines was to land one battalion, 3-7, in the assault over Orange Beach 3, the southernmost of the five designated beaches. In the confusion of the landing's first few minutes, K-3-5 actually got in ahead of the assault companies of 3-7, and slightly farther to the right than intended. As luck would have it, the two companies got mixed together as the right flank of the division. For about 15 minutes, we were the exposed right flank of the entire beachhead.
We started to move inland. We had gone only a few yards when an enemy machine gun opened up from a scrub thicket to our right. Japanese 81mm and 90mm mortars then opened up on us. Everyone hit the deck. I dove into a shallow crater. The company was completely pinned down. All movement ceased. The shells fell faster, until I couldn't make out individual explosions, just continuous, crashing rumbles, with an occasional ripping sound of shrapnel tearing low through the air overhead amid the roar. The air was murky with smoke and dust. Every muscle in my body was as tight as a piano wire. I shuddered and shook, as though I were having a mild convulsion. Sweat flowed profusely. I prayed, clenched my teeth, squeezed my carbine stock, and cursed the Japanese. Our lieutenant, a Cape Gloucester veteran, who was nearby, seemed to be in about the same shape. From the meager protection of my shallow crater, I pitied him, or anyone, out on that flat coral. The heavy mortar barrage went on without slackening. I thought it would never stop. I was terrified by the big shells arching down all around us. One was bound to fall directly into my hole, I thought. If any orders were passed along, or if anyone yelled for a corpsman, I never heard it in all the noise. It was as though I was out there on the battlefield all by myself, utterly forlorn and helpless in a tempest of violent explosions. All any man could do was sweat it out and pray for survival. It would have been sure suicide to stand up in that firestorm. Under my first barrage since the fast-moving events of hitting the beach, I learned a new sensation. Utter and absolute helplessness. The shelling lifted in about half an hour, although it seemed to me to have crashed on for hours. Time had no meaning to me. This was particularly true when under a heavy shelling. I never could judge how long it lasted. Orders then came to move out and I got up, covered by a layer of coral dust. I felt like jelly, and I couldn't believe any of us had survived that barrage. The walking wounded began coming past us on their way to the beach, where they would board Amtrak's to be taken out to one of the ships. An NCO, who was a particular friend of mine, hurried by, holding a bloody battle dressing over his upper left arm. "Hit bad?" I yelled. His face lit up in a broad grin, and he said, jauntily, "Don't feel sorry for me, Sledgehammer. I got the million-dollar wound. It's all over for me." We waved as he hurried on out of the war. We had to be alert constantly as we moved through the thick, sniper-infested scrub. We received orders to halt in an open area as I came upon the first enemy dead I had ever seen. A dead Japanese medical corpsman and two riflemen. The medic apparently had been trying to administer aid when he was killed by one of our shells. His medical chest lay open beside him, and the various bandages and medicines were arranged neatly in compartments. The corpsman was on his back. His abdominal cavity laid bare. I stared in horror, shocked at the glistening viscera bespecked with fine coral dust. "This can't have been a human being," I agonized.
It looked more like the guts of one of the many rabbits or squirrels I had cleaned on hunting trips as a boy. I felt sick as I stared at the corpses. A sweating, dusty Company K veteran came up, looked first at the dead, and then at me. He slung his M1 rifle over his shoulder and leaned over the bodies. With the thumb and forefinger of one hand, he deftly plucked a pair of horn-rimmed glasses from the face of the corpsman. This was done as casually as a guest plucking an hors d'oeuvre from a tray at a cocktail party. "Sledgehammer," he said reproachfully, "don't stand there with your mouth open when there's all these good souvenirs laying around." He held the glasses for me to see and added, "Look how thick that glass is. These sons of bitches must be half blind, but it don't seem to mess up their marksmanship any." He then removed a Nambu pistol, slipped the belt off the corpse, and took the leather holster. He pulled off the steel helmet, reached inside, and took out a neatly folded Japanese flag covered with writing. The veteran pitched the helmet on the coral, where it clanked and rattled, rolled the corpse over, and started pawing through the combat pack. The veteran's buddy came up and started stripping the other Japanese corpses. His take was a flag and other items. He then removed the bolts from the Japanese rifles and broke the stocks against the coral to render them useless to infiltrators. The first veteran said, "See you, Sledgehammer. Don't take any wooden nickels." He and his buddy moved on. I hadn't budged an inch or said a word. Just stood, glued to the spot, almost in a trance. The corpses were sprawled where the veterans had dragged them around to get into their packs and pockets. Would I become this casual and calloused about enemy dead? I wondered. Would the war dehumanize me so that I too could field strip enemy dead with such nonchalance? The time soon came when it didn't bother me a bit. Within a few yards of the scene, one of our hospital corpsmen worked in a small, shallow defile treating Marine wounded. I went over and sat on the hot coral by him. The corpsman was on his knees, bending over a young Marine who had just died on a stretcher. A blood-soaked battle dressing was on the side of the dead man's neck. His fine, handsome, boyish face was ashen. What a pitiful waste, I thought. He can't be a day over 17 years old. I thanked God his mother couldn't see him. The corpsman held the dead Marine's chin tenderly between the thumb and fingers of his left hand and made the sign of the cross with his right hand. Tears streamed down his dusty, tanned, grief-contorted face while he sobbed quietly. The wounded, who had received morphine, sat or lay around like zombies and patiently awaited the doc's attention. Shells roared overhead in both directions, an occasional one falling nearby, and machine guns rattled incessantly like chattering demons. We moved inland. The scrub may have slowed the company, but it concealed us from the heavy enemy shelling that was holding up other companies facing the open airfield. I could hear the deep rumble of the shelling and dreaded that we might move into it. That our battalion executive officer had been killed a few moments after hitting the beach, and that the Amtrak carrying most of our battalion's field telephone equipment and operators had been destroyed on the reef, made control difficult. The companies of 3-5 lost contact with each other and with 3-7 on our right flank. As I passed the different units and exchanged greetings with friends, I was astonished at their faces. When I tried to smile at a comment a buddy made, my face felt as tight as a drumhead. My facial muscles were so tensed from the strain that I actually felt it was impossible to smile. With a shock, I realized that the faces of my squad mates and everyone around me looked mask-like and unfamiliar. As we pushed eastward, We halted briefly along a north-south trail. Word was passed that we had to move forward faster to a trail where we would come up abreast of 3-7. We continued through the thick scrub and heavy sniper fire until we came out into a clearing overlooking the ocean. Company K had reached the eastern shore. We had reached our objective. To our front was a shallow bay with barbed wire entanglements, iron tetrahedrons, and other obstacles against landing craft. I was glad we hadn't tried to invade this coast. About a dozen Company K riflemen commenced firing at Japanese soldiers waiting along the reef several hundred yards away at the mouth of the bay. Other Marines joined us. The enemy were moving out from a narrow extension of the mangrove swamp on the left towards the southeastern promontory on our right. About a dozen enemy soldiers were alternately swimming and running along the reef. Some of the time, only their heads were above the water, as my buddies sent rifle fire into their midst. Most of the running enemy went down with a splash. We were elated over reaching the eastern shore, and at being able to fire on the enemy in the open. A few Japanese escaped and scrambled among the rocks on the promontory. "Okay, you guys, line them up and squeeze them off," said a sergeant. "You don't kill them with the noise. It's the slugs that do it. You guys couldn't hit a bull in the ass with a bass fiddle," he roared. Several more Japanese ran out from the cover of the mangroves. A burst of rifle fire sent every one of them splashing. "That's better," growled the sergeant. The mortarmen put down our loads and stood by to set up the guns. We didn't fire at the enemy with our carbines. Rifles were more effective than carbines at that range. So we just watched. Firing increased from our rear. We had no contact with Marine units on our right or left, but the veterans weren't concerned with anything but the enemy on the reef. "Stand by to move out," came the order. "What the hell?" grumbled a veteran as we headed back into the scrub. "We fight like hell and reach our objective, and they order us to fall back?" Others joined in the grumbling. "Oh, knock it off. We gotta gain contact with the 7th Marines," an NCO said. We headed back into the thick scrub. For some time, I completely lost my bearings and had no idea where we were going.
Unknown to the Marines, there were two parallel north-south trails about 200 yards apart, winding through the thick scrub. Poor maps, poor visibility, and numerous snipers made it difficult to distinguish the two trails. When 3-5, with Company K on its right flank, reached the first westernmost trail, it was then actually abreast of 3-7. However, due to poor visibility, contact couldn't be made between the two battalions. It was thought 3-5 was too far to the rear, so 3-5 was ordered to move forward to come abreast of 3-7. By the time this error was realized, 3-5 had pushed 300 to 400 yards ahead of the 7th Marines flank. For the second time on D-Day, K-3-5 was the forwardmost exposed right flank element of the division. The entire 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, formed a deep salient, reaching into enemy territory to the east coast. To make matters worse, the battalion's three companies had lost contact with each other. These isolated units were in critical danger of being cut off and surrounded by the Japanese.
The weather was getting increasingly hot, and I was soaked with sweat. I began eating salt tablets and taking frequent drinks of tepid water from my canteens. We were warned to save our water as long as possible, because no one knew when we would get any more. A sweating runner with a worried face came up from the rear. "Hey, you guys, where's K Company CO?" he asked. We told him where we thought AKAC could be located. "What's the hot dope?" someone asked, with the same anxious question always put to runners. "Battalion CP says we just got to establish contact with the 7th Marines, because if the Nips counterattack, they'll come right through the gap," he said as he hurried on. "Jesus," said a man near me. We moved forward and came up with the rest of the company in a clearing. The platoons formed up and took casualty reports. Japanese mortar and artillery fire increased. The shelling became heavy, indicating the probability of a counterattack. Most of their fire whistled over us and fell to our rear. This seemed strange, although fortunate to me at the time. The order came for us to move out a short distance to the edge of the scrub. At approximately 1650, I looked out across the open airfield towards the southern extremities of the Coral Ridges, collectively called Bloody Nose Ridge, and saw vehicles of some sort moving amid swirling clouds of dust. "Hey," I said to a veteran next to me, "what are those Amtraks doing all the way across the airfield towards the Jap lines?"
"Them ain't Amtraks. They're nip tanks," he said.
Shell bursts appeared among the enemy tanks. Some of our Sherman tanks had arrived at the edge of the airfield on our left and opened fire. Because of the clouds of dust and the shell fire, I couldn't see much and didn't see any enemy infantry. But the firing on our left was heavy. Word came for us to deploy on the double. The riflemen formed a line at the edge of the scrub along a trail and lay prone, trying to take what cover they could. From the beginning to the end on Peleliu, it was all but impossible to dig into the hard coral rock, so the men piled rocks around themselves or got behind logs and debris. Snafu and I set up our 60mm mortar a few yards behind them, across the trail in a shallow crater. Everyone got edgy as the order came.
"Stand by to repel counterattack. Counterattack hitting I Company's front."
I didn't know where company I was, but I thought it was on our left, somewhere. Although I had great confidence in our officers and NCOs, it seemed to me that we were alone and confused in the middle of a rumbling chaos, with snipers everywhere and with no contact with any other units. I thought all of us would be lost.
"They need to get some more damn troops up here," growled Snafu, his standard remark in a tight spot.
Snafu set up the gun, and I removed an HE, high explosive, shell from a canister in my ammo bag. At last we could return fire. Snafu yelled, "Fire!" Just then a Marine tank to our rear mistook us for enemy troops. As soon as my hand went up to drop the round down the tube, a machine gun cut loose. It sounded like one of ours, and from the rear of all places. As I peeped over the edge of the crater, through the dust and smoke, and saw a Sherman tank in a clearing behind us, the tank fired its 75mm gun off to our right rear. The shell exploded nearby, around a bend in the same trail we were on. I then heard the report of a Japanese field gun located there as it returned fire on the tank. Again I tried to fire, but the machine gun opened up as before.
"Sledgehammer, don't let him hit that shell. We'll all be blown to hell," said a worried ammo carrier, crouched in the crater near me.
"Don't worry, that's my handy just about hit," I snapped.
Our tank and the Japanese field gun kept up their duel.
By God, when that tank knocks out that nip gun, he'll swing his 75 over this way, and it'll be our ass. "He thinks we're nips," said a veteran in the crater.
"Oh, Jesus," someone moaned. A surge of panic rose within me. In a brief moment, our tank had reduced me from a well-trained, determined assistant mortar gunner to a quivering mass of terror. It was not just that I was being fired at by a machine gun that unnerved me so terribly, but that it was one of ours. To be killed by the enemy was bad enough. That was a real possibility I had prepared myself for. But to be killed by mistake, by my own comrades, was something I found hard to accept. It was just too much. An authoritative voice across the trail yelled, "Secure the mortar!" A volunteer crawled off to the left, and soon the tank ceased firing on us. We learned later that our tankers were firing on us because we had moved too far ahead. They thought we were enemy support for the field gun. This also explained why the enemy shelling was passing over and exploding behind us. Tragically, the Marine who saved us by identifying us to the tanker was shot off the tank and killed by a sniper. The heavy firing on our left had about subsided, so the Japanese counterattack had been broken. Regrettably, I hadn't helped at all, because we were pinned down by one of our own tanks. Some of us went along the trail and looked at the Japanese field gun. It was a well-made, formidable-looking piece of artillery, but I was surprised that the wheels were the heavy wooden kind, typical of field guns of the 19th century. The Japanese gun crew was sprawled around the piece. "Them's the biggest nips I ever saw," one veteran said. "Look at them sons of bitches. They's all over 6 foot tall," said another. "That must be some of that flower of the Kwangtung Army we've been hearing about," put in a corporal. The Japanese counterattack was no wild, suicide bonsai charge, such as Marine experience in the past would have led us to expect. Numerous times during D-Day, I heard the dogmatic claim by experienced veterans that the enemy would bonsai. "They'll pull a bonsai, and we'll tear their ass up. Then we can get the hell off this hot rock, and maybe the CG will send the division back to Melbourne." Rather than a bonsai, the Japanese counter-thrust turned out to be a well-coordinated tank infantry attack. Approximately one company of Japanese infantry, together with about 13 tanks, had moved carefully across the airfield, until annihilated by the Marines on our left. This was our first warning that the Japanese might fight differently on Peleliu than they had elsewhere. Just before dusk, a Japanese mortar concentration hit 3-5's command post. Our CO, Lieutenant Colonel Austin C. Schaffner, was hit while trying to establish contact among the companies of our battalion. He was evacuated and put aboard a hospital ship. Companies I, K, and L couldn't regain contact before nightfall. Each dug in a circular defense for the night. The situation was precarious. We were isolated, nearly out of water in the terrible heat, and ammunition was low. Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Walt, accompanied by only a runner, came out into that pitch dark, enemy-infested scrub, located all the companies, and directed us into the division's line on the airfield. He should have won a Medal of Honor for that feat. Rumor had it, as we dug in, that the division had suffered heavy casualties in the landing and subsequent fighting. The veterans I knew said it had been about the worst day of fighting they had ever seen. It was an immense relief to me when we got to our gun pit, completed, and had registered in our guns by firing 2 or 3 rounds of HE into an area out in front of Company K. My thirst was almost unbearable. My stomach was tied in knots, and sweat soaked me. Dissolving some K-ration dextrose tablets in my mouth helped, and I took the last sip of my dwindling water supply. We had no idea when relief would get through with additional water. Artillery shells shrieked and whistled back and forth overhead with increasing frequency, and small arms fire rattled everywhere. In the eerie green light of star shells swinging pendulum-like on their parachutes so that shadows danced and swayed around crazily, I started taking off my right shoe. "Sledgehammer, what the hell are you doing?" Snafu asked in an exasperated tone. "Taking off my boondockers. My feet hurt," I replied. "Have you gone Asiatic?" he asked excitedly. "What the hell are you gonna do in your stocking feet if the nips come busting out of that jungle or across this field? We may have to get out of this hole and haul tail if we're ordered to. They're probably gonna pull a bonsai before daybreak. And how do you reckon you'll move around on this coral in your stockings?" I said that I just wasn't thinking. He reamed me out good and told me we would be lucky to get our shoes off before the island was secured. I thanked God my foxhole buddy was a combat veteran. Snafu then nonchalantly drew his K-bar and stuck it in the coral gravel near his right hand. My stomach tightened, and goose flesh chilled my back and shoulders at the sight of the long blade in the greenish light, and the realization of why he placed it within such easy reach. He then checked his .45 automatic pistol. I followed his example with my K-bar as I crouched on the other side of the mortar, checked my carbine, and looked over the mortar shells, HE and flares, stacked up within reach. We settled down for the long night. "Is that theirs or ours, Snafu?" I asked each time a shell went over. There was nothing subtle or intimate about the approach and explosion of an artillery shell. When I heard the whistle of an approaching one in the distance, every muscle in my body contracted. I braced myself in a puny effort to keep from being swept away. I felt utterly helpless. As the fiendish whistle grew louder, my teeth ground against each other. My heart pounded. My mouth dried. My eyes narrowed. Sweat poured over me. My breath came in short, irregular gasps, and I was afraid to swallow lest I choke. I always prayed, sometimes out loud. Under certain conditions of range and terrain, I could hear the shells approaching from a considerable distance, thus prolonging the suspense into seemingly unending torture. At the instant the voice of the shell grew the loudest, it terminated in a flash and a deafening explosion similar to the crash of a loud clap of thunder. The ground shook, and the concussion hurt my ears. Shell fragments tore the air apart as they rushed out, whirring and ripping. Rocks and dirt clattered onto the deck as smoke of the exploded shell dissipated. To be under a barrage or prolonged shelling simply magnified all the terrible physical and emotional effects of one shell. To me, artillery was an invention of hell. The onrushing whistle and scream of the big steel package of destruction was the pinnacle of violent fury and the embodiment of pent-up evil. It was the essence of violence and of man's inhumanity to man. I developed a passionate hatred for shells. To be killed by a bullet seemed so clean and surgical. But shells would not only tear and rip the body, they tortured one's mind almost beyond the brink of sanity. After each shell, I was wrung out, limp, and exhausted. During prolonged shelling, I often had to restrain myself and fight back a wild, inexorable urge to scream, to sob, and to cry. As Peleliu dragged on, I feared that if I ever lost control of myself under shell fire, my mind would be shattered. I hated shells, as much for their damage to the mind as to the body. To be under heavy shell fire was, to me, by far the most terrifying of combat experiences. Each time it left me feeling more forlorn and helpless, more fatalistic, and with less confidence that I could escape the dreadful law of averages that inexorably reduced our numbers. Fear is many-faceted and has many subtle nuances. But the terror and desperation endured under heavy shelling are by far the most unbearable. The night wore on endlessly, and I was hardly able to catch even so much as a catnap. Toward the pre-dawn hours, numerous enemy artillery pieces concentrated their fire on the area of scrub jungle from which Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Walt had brought us. The shells screeched and whined over us and crashed beyond in the scrub. "Whoo, boy! Listen to them nip gunners plaster that area," said a buddy in the next hole. "Yeah," Snafu said. "They must think we're still out there. And I bet you they'll counterattack right across through that place, too." "Thank God we are here and not out there," our buddy said. The barrage increased in tempo as the Japanese gave the vacant scrub jungle a real pounding. When the barrage finally subsided,
I heard someone say with a chuckle. Aw, don't knock it off now, you bastards. Fire all your goddamn shells out there in the wrong place. Don't worry, Knucklehead. They'll have plenty left to fire in the right place, which is going to be where they see us when daylight comes, another voice said. Supplies had been slow in keeping up with the need of the 5th Marines Infantry Companies on D-Day. The Japanese kept heavy artillery, mortar, and machine gun fire on the entire regimental beach throughout the day. Enemy artillery and mortar observers called down their fire on amphibian vehicles as soon as they reached the beach. This made it difficult to get the critical supplies ashore and the wounded evacuated. All of Peleliu was a front line on D-Day. No one but the dead was out of reach of enemy fire. The shore party people did their best, but they couldn't make up for the heavy losses of Amtrak's needed to bring the supplies to us. We weren't aware of the problems on the beach, being too occupied with our own. We griped, cursed, and prayed that water would get to us. I had used mine more sparingly than some men had, but I finally emptied both of my canteens by the time we finished the gun pit. Dissolving dextrose tablets in my mouth helped a little, but my thirst grew worse through the night. For the first time in my life, I appreciated fully the motion picture cliche of a man on a desert crying, "Water! Water!" Artillery shells still passed back and forth overhead just before dawn, but there wasn't much small arms fire in our area. Abruptly, there swept over us some of the most intense Japanese machine gun fire I ever saw concentrated in such a small area. Tracers streaked, and bullets cracked, not more than a foot over the top of our gun pit. We lay flat on our backs and waited as the burst ended. The gun cut loose again, joined by a second and possibly a third. Streams of bluish-white tracers, American tracers were red, poured thickly overhead, apparently coming from somewhere near the airfield. The crossfire kept up for at least a quarter of an hour. They really poured it on. Shortly before the machine guns opened fire, we had received word to move out at daylight with the entire 5th Marine Regiment in an attack across the airfield. I prayed the machine gun fire would subside before we had to move out. We were pinned down tightly. To raise anything above the edge of the gun pit would have resulted in its being cut off, as though by a giant scythe. After about 15 minutes, firing ceased abruptly. We sighed in relief. D plus one. Dawn finally came, and with it, the temperature rose rapidly. "Where the hell is our water?" growled men around me. We had suffered many cases of heat prostration the day before, and needed water, or we'd all pass out during the attack, I thought. "Stand by to move out," came the order. We squared away all of our personal gear. Snafu secured the gun, took it down by folding the bipod and strapping it, while I packed my remaining shells in my ammo bag. "I've got to get some water, or I'm going to crack up," I said. At that moment, a buddy nearby yelled and beckoned to us, "Come on, we found a well." I snatched up my carbine and took off, empty canteens bouncing on my cartridge belt. About 25 yards away, a group of Company K men gathered at a hole about 15 feet in diameter and 10 feet deep. I peered over the edge. At the bottom, and to one side was a small pool of milky-looking water. Japanese shells were beginning to fall on the airfield, but I was too thirsty to care. One of the men was already in the hole, filling canteens and passing them up. The buddy who had called me was drinking from a helmet, with its liner removed. He gulped down the milky stuff and said, "It isn't beer, but it's wet." Helmets and canteens were passed up to those of us waiting. "Don't bunch up, you guys. We'll draw Jap fire sure as hell," shouted one man. The first man who drank the water looked at me and said, "Oh, I feel sick." A company corpsman came up yelling, "Don't drink that water, you guys! It may be poisoned!" I had just lifted a full helmet to my lips when the man next to me fell, holding his sides
and retching violently. I threw down my water, milky with coral dust, and started assisting the corpsman with the man who was ill. He went to the rear, where he recovered. Whether it was poisoned or pollution, we never knew. "Get your gear on and stand by," someone yelled. Frustrated and angry, I headed back to the gun pit. A detail came up about that time with water cans, ammo, and rations. A friend and I helped each other pour water out of a 5-gallon can into our canteen cups. Our hands shook. We were so eager to quench our thirst. I was amazed that the water looked brown in my aluminum canteen cup. No matter, I took a big gulp and almost spit it out despite my terrible thirst. It was awful, full of rust and oil. It stunk. I looked into the cup in disbelief as a blue film of oil floated lazily on the surface of the smelly brown liquid. Cramps gripped the pit of my stomach. My friend looked up from his cup and groaned, "Sledgehammer, are you thinking what I'm thinking?" "I sure am. That oil drum steam cleaning detail on Pavuvu," I said wearily. We had been together on a detail assigned to clean out the drums. "I'm a son of a bitch," he growled. "I'll never goof off on another work party as long as I live." I told him I didn't think it was our fault. We weren't the only ones assigned to the detail, and it was obvious to us from the start, if not to some supply officer, that the method we had been ordered to use didn't really clean the drums. But that knowledge was slight consolation out there on the Peleliu airfield in the increasing heat. As awful as the stuff was, we had to drink it or suffer heat exhaustion. After I drained my cup, a residue of rust resembling coffee grounds remained, and my stomach ached. We picked up our gear and prepared to move out in preparation for the attack across the airfield. Because 3-5's line during the night faced south and was back-to-back with that of 2-5, we had to move to the right and prepare to attack northward across the airfield with the other battalions of the regiment. The Japanese shelling of our lines began at daylight, so we had to move out fast and in dispersed formation. We finally got into position for the attack and were told to hit the deck until ordered to move again. This suited me fine, because the Japanese shelling was getting worse. Our artillery, ships, and planes were laying down a terrific amount of fire in front, on the airfield, and ridges beyond in preparation for our attack. Our pre-attack barrage lasted about half an hour. I knew we would move out when it ended. As I lay on the blistering hot coral and looked across the open airfield, heat waves shimmered and danced, distorting the view of Bloody Nose Ridge. A hot wind blew in our faces. An NCO hurried by, crouching low and yelling, "Keep moving out there, you guys. There's less chance you'll be hit if you go across fast and don't stop." "Let's go!" shouted an officer who waved toward the airfield. We moved at a walk, then a trot, in widely dispersed waves. 4 infantry battalions, from left to right, 2-1, 1-5, 2-5, and 3-5. This put us on the edge of the airfield, moved across the open, fire-swept airfield. My only concern then was my duty and survival, not panoramic combat scenes. But I often wondered later what that attack looked like to aerial observers and to those not immersed in the firestorms. All I was aware of were the small area immediately around me and the deafening noise. Bloody Nose Ridge dominated the entire airfield. The Japanese had concentrated their heavy weapons on high ground. These were directed from observation posts at elevations as high as 300 feet from which they could look down on us as we advanced. I could see men moving ahead of my squad, but I didn't know whether our battalion, 3-5, was moving across behind 2-5 and then wheeling to the right,
There were also men about 20 yards to our rear. We moved rapidly in the open, amid craters and coral rubble, through ever-increasing enemy fire. I saw men to my right and left, running bent as low as possible. The shells screeched and whistled, exploding all around us. In many respects, it was more terrifying than the landing, because there were no vehicles to carry us along, not even the thin steel sides of an Amtrak for protection. We were exposed, running on our own power, through a veritable shower of deadly metal and the constant crash of explosions. For me, the attack resembled World War I movies I had seen of suicidal Allied infantry attacks through shell fire on the Western Front. I clenched my teeth, squeezed my carbine stock, and recited over and over to myself, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff comfort me." The sun bore down unmercifully, and the heat was exhausting. Smoke and dust from the barrage limited my vision. The ground seemed to sway back and forth under the concussions. I felt as though I were floating along in the vortex of some unreal thunderstorm. Japanese bullets snapped and cracked, and tracers went by me on both sides at waist high. This deadly small arms fire seemed almost insignificant amid the erupting shells. Explosions and the hum and the growl of shell fragments shredded the air. Chunks of blasted coral stung my face and hands, while steel fragments spattered down on the hard rock like hail on a city street. Everywhere shells flashed like giant firecrackers. Through the haze, I saw Marines stumble and pitch forward as they got hit. I then looked neither right nor left, but just straight to my front. The farther we went, the worse it got. The noise and concussion pressed into my ears like a vice. I gritted my teeth and braced myself in anticipation of the shock of being struck down at any moment. It seemed impossible that any of us could make it across. We passed several craters that offered shelter, but I remembered the order to keep moving. Because of the superb discipline and excellent esprit of the Marines, it had never occurred to us that the attack might fail. About halfway across, I stumbled and fell forward. At that instant, a large shell exploded to my left with a flash and a roar. A fragment ricocheted off the deck and growled over my head as I went down. On my right, Snafu let out a grunt and fell as the fragment struck him. As he went down, he grabbed his left side. I crawled quickly to him. Fortunately, the fragment had spent much of its force and luckily hit against Snafu's heavy web pistol belt. The threads on the broad belt were frayed in about an inch square area. I knelt beside him, and we checked his side. He had only a bruise to show for his incredible luck. On the deck, I saw the chunk of steel that had hit him. It was about an inch square and a half inch thick. I picked up the fragment and showed it to him. Snafu motioned towards his pack. Terrified though I was amid the hellish chaos, I calmly juggled the fragment around in my hands. It was still hot, and I dropped it into his pack. He yelled something that sounded dimly like, "Let's go!" I reached for the carrying strap of the mortar, but he pushed my hand away and lifted the gun to his shoulder. We got up and moved on as fast as we could. Finally, we got across and caught up with other members of our company who lay panting and sweating amid low bushes on the northeastern side of the airfield. How far we had come in the open, I never knew, but it must have been several hundred yards. Everyone was visibly shaken by the thunderous barrage we had just come through. When I looked into the eyes of those fine Guadalcanal and Cape Gloucester veterans, some of America's best, I no longer felt ashamed of my trembling hands and almost laughed at myself with relief. To be shelled by massed artillery and mortars is absolutely terrifying, but to be shelled in the open is terror compounded beyond the belief of anyone who hasn't experienced it. The attack across Peleliu's airfield was the worst combat experience I had during the entire war. It surpassed by intensity of the blast and shock of the bursting shells
all the subsequent horrifying ordeals on Peleliu and Okinawa. The heat was incredibly intense. The temperature that day reached 105 degrees in the shade. We were not in the shade, and would soar to 115 degrees on subsequent days. Corman tagged numerous Marines with heat prostration as being too weak to continue. We evacuated them. My boondockers were so full of sweat that my feet felt squishy when I walked. Lying on my back, I held up first one foot and then the other. Water literally poured out of each shoe. "Hey, Sledgehammer," chuckled a man sprawled next to me. "You been walking on water?" "Maybe that's why he didn't get hit coming across that airfield," laughed another. I tried to grin and was glad the inevitable wisecracks had started up again. Because of the shape of the airfield, 3-5 was pinched out of the line by 2-5 on our left and 3-7 on our right after our crossing. We swung eastward, and Company K tied in with 3-7, which was attacking in the swampy areas on the eastern side of the airfield. As we picked up our gear, a veteran remarked to me with a jerk of his head toward the airfield where the shelling continued, "That was a rough duty. Hate to have to do that every day." We moved through the swamps amid sniper fire and dug in for the night, with our backs to the sea. I positioned my mortar in a meager gun pit on a slight rise of ground about 15 feet from a sheer rock bluff that dropped about 10 feet to the ocean. The jungle growth was extremely thick, but we had a clear hole in the jungle canopy above the gun pit through which we could fire the mortar without having shells hit the foliage and explode. Most of the men in the company were out of sight through the thick mangroves. Still short of water, everyone was weakened by the heat and the exertions of the day. I had used my water as sparingly as possible and had to eat 12 salt tablets that day. We kept close count on these tablets. They caused retching if we took more than necessary. The enemy infiltration that followed was a nightmare. Illumination fired above the airfield the previous night, D-Day, had discouraged infiltration in my sector. But others had experienced plenty of the hellish sort of thing we now faced and would suffer every night for the remainder of our time on Peleliu. The Japanese were noted for their infiltration tactics. On Peleliu, they refined them and practiced them at a level of intensity not seen in the past. After we had dug in late that afternoon, we followed a procedure used nearly every night. Using directions from our observer, we registered in the mortar by firing a couple of HE shells into a defilade or some similar avenue of approach in front of the company not covered by our machine gun or rifle fire where the enemy might advance. We then set up alternate aiming stakes to mark other terrain features on which we could fire. Everyone lighted up a smoke, and the password for the night was whispered along the line, passed from foxhole to foxhole. The password always contained the letter L, which the Japanese had difficulty pronouncing the way an American would. Word came along as to the disposition of the platoons of the company and of the units on our flanks. We checked our weapons and placed equipment for quick access in the coming night. As darkness fell, the order was passed. "The smoking lamp is out." All talking ceased. One man in each foxhole settled down as comfortably as he could to sleep on the jagged rock, while his buddy strained eyes and ears to detect any movement or sound in the darkness. An occasional Japanese mortar shell came into the area, but things were pretty quiet for a couple of hours. We threw up a few HE shells as harassing fire to discourage movement in front of the company. I could hear the sea lapping gently against the base of the rocks behind us. The Japanese soon began trying to infiltrate all over the company front and along the shore to our rear. We heard sporadic bursts of small arms fire and the bang of grenades. Our fire discipline had to be strict in such situations so as to not mistakenly shoot a fellow Marine. The loose accusation was often made during the war that Americans were trigger-happy at night and shot at anything that moved. This accusation was often correct when referring to rear area or inexperienced troops. But in the rifle companies, it was also accepted as gospel that anybody who moved out of his hole at night without first informing the men around him, and who didn't reply immediately with a password upon being challenged, could expect to get shot. Suddenly, movement in the dried vegetation toward the front of the gun pit got my attention. I turned cautiously around and waited, holding Snafu's cocked .45 automatic pistol at the ready. The rustling movements drew closer. My heart pounded. It was definitely not one of Peleliu's numerous land crabs that scuttled over the ground all night, every night. Someone was slowly crawling toward the gun pit. Then, silence. More noise, then silence. Rustling noises, then silence. The typical pattern. It must be a Japanese trying to slip in as close as possible, stopping frequently to prevent detection, I thought. He probably had seen the muzzle flash when I fired the mortar. He would throw a grenade at any moment or jump me with his bayonet. I couldn't see a thing in the pale light and inky blackness of the shadows. Crouching low so as to see better any silhouette against the sky above me, I flipped off the thumb safety on the big pistol. A helmeted figure loomed up against the night sky in front of the gun pit. I couldn't tell from the silhouette whether the helmet was U.S. or Japanese. Aiming the automatic at the center of the head, I pressed the grip safety as I also squeezed the trigger slightly to take up the slack. The thought raced through my mind that he was too close to use his grenade, so he would probably use a bayonet or knife on me. My hand was steady even though I was scared. It was he or I. "What's the password?" I said in a low voice. No answer. "Password," I demanded as my finger tightened on the trigger. The big pistol would fire and buck with recoil in a moment, but to hurry and jerk the trigger would mean to miss for sure. Then he'd be on me. "Sledgehammer," stammered the figure. I eased up on the trigger. "It's DeLo, Jay DeLo. You got any water?" "Jay, why didn't you give me the password? I nearly shot you," I gasped. He saw the pistol and moaned. "Oh, Jesus." As he realized what had nearly happened. I thought you knew it was me," he said weakly. Jay was one of my closest friends. He was a Gloucester veteran and knew better than to prowl around the way he had just done. If my finger had applied the last bit of pressure to that trigger, Jay would have died instantly. It would have been his own fault, but that wouldn't have mattered to me. My life would have been ruined if I had killed him, even under those circumstances. My right hand trembled violently as I lowered the big automatic. I had to flip on the thumb safety with my left hand. My right thumb was too weak. I felt nauseated and weak and wanted to cry. Jay crept over and sat on the edge of the gun pit. "I'm sorry, Sledgehammer. I thought you knew it was me," he said. After handing him a canteen, I shuddered violently and thanked God that Jay was still alive. "Just how in the hell could I tell if it was you in the dark with the nips all over the place?" I snarled. Then I reamed out one of the best friends I ever had. Heading north. "Get your gear on and stand by to move out." We shouldered our loads and began moving slowly out of the thick swamp. As I passed a shallow foxhole where Robert B. Oswald had been dug in, I asked a man nearby if the word were true about Oswald being killed. Sadly, he said yes. Oswald had been fatally wounded in the head. A bright young mind that aspired to delve into the mysteries of the human brain to alleviate human suffering, had itself been destroyed by a tiny chunk of metal. What a waste, I thought. War is such a self-defeating, organized madness, the way it destroys a nation's best. I wondered also about the hopes and aspirations of a dead Japanese we had just dragged out of the water. But those of us caught up in the maelstrom of combat had little compassion for the enemy. As a wise, salty NCO had put it one day on Pavuvu when asked by a replacement if he ever felt sorry for the Japanese when they got hit. Hell no! It's them or us! We moved out, keeping our five-pace interval through the thick swamp toward the sound of heavy firing. The heat was almost unbearable, and we were halted frequently to prevent heat prostration in the 115-degree temperature. We came to the eastern edge of the airfield and halted in the shade of a scrub thicket. Throwing down our gear, we fell on the deck, sweating, panting, exhausted. I had no more than reached for a canteen when a rifle bullet snapped overhead. "He's close! Get down!" said an officer. The rifle cracked again. "Sounds like he's right through there a little way," the officer said. "I'll get him," said Howard Neese. "Okay, go ahead, but watch yourself." Neese, a Gloucester veteran, grabbed his rifle and took off into the scrub with the nonchalance of a hunter going after a rabbit in a bush. He angled to one side so as to steal up on the sniper from the rear. We waited a few anxious moments, then heard two M1 shots. "Oh, Howard got him," confidently remarked one of the men. Soon Howard reappeared, wearing a triumphant grin and carrying a Japanese rifle and some personal effects. Everyone congratulated him on his skill, and he reacted with his usual modesty. "Rack 'em up, boys," he laughed. We moved out in a few minutes, through some knee-high bushes, onto the open area at the edge of the airfield. The heat was terrific. When we halted again, we lay under the meager shade of the bushes. I held up each foot and let the sweat pour out of my boondockers. A man on the crew of the other weapon in our mortar section passed out. He was a Gloucester veteran, but Peleliu's heat proved too much for him. We evacuated him, but unlike some heat prostration cases, he never returned to the company. Some men pulled the rear border of their camouflaged helmet cover out from between the steel and the liner so the cloth hung down over the backs of the necks. This gave them some protection against the blistering sun, but they looked like the French Foreign Legion in a desert. After a brief rest, we continued in dispersed order. We could see Bloody Nose Ridge to our left front. Northward, from that particular area, 2nd Battalion 1st Marines, 2-1, was fighting desperately against Japanese hidden in well-protected caves. We were moving up to relieve 1st Battalion 5th Marines, 1-5, and would tie in with the 1st Marines. Then we were to attack northward, along the eastern side of the ridges. On this particular day, 17 September, the relief was slow and difficult. As 3-5 moved in and the men of 1-5 moved out, the Japanese in the ridges on our left front poured on the artillery and mortar fire. I pitied those tired men in 1-5 as they tried to extricate themselves without casualties. Their battalion, as with the others in the 5th Marines, had had a rough time crossing the airfield through the heavy fire the previous day. But once they got across, they met heavy resistance from pillboxes on the eastern side. We had been more fortunate. After getting across the airfield, 3-5 moved into the swamp, which wasn't defended as heavily. With the relief of 1-5 finally completed, we tied in with the 1st Marines on our left and 2-5 on our right. Our battalion was to attack during the afternoon through the low ground along the eastern side of Bloody Nose, while 2-5 was to clean out the jungle between our right flank and the eastern shore. As soon as we moved forward, we came under heavy flanking fire from Bloody Nose Ridge on our left. Snafu delivered his latest communique on the tactical situation to me as we hugged the deck for protection. "They need to get some more damn troops up here," he growled. Our artillery was called in, but our mortars could fire only to the front of the company and not on the left flank area, because that was in the area of the 1st Marines. The Japanese observers on the ridge had a clear, unobstructed view of us. Their artillery shells whined and shrieked, accompanied by the deadly whispering of the mortar shells. Enemy fire grew more intense until we were pinned down. We were getting the first bitter taste of Bloody Nose Ridge, and we had increasing compassion for the first Marines on our left who were battering squarely into it. The Japanese ceased firing when our movement stopped. Yet as surely as three men grouped together, or anyone started moving, enemy mortars opened up on us. If a general movement occurred, their artillery joined in. The Japanese began to demonstrate the excellent fire discipline that was to characterize their use of all weapons on Peleliu. They fired only when they could expect to inflict maximum casualties and stop firing as soon as the opportunity passed. Thus, our observers and planes had difficulty finding their well-camouflaged positions in the ridges. When the enemy ceased firing artillery and mortars from caves, they shut protective steel doors and waited while our artillery, naval guns, and 81mm mortars blasted away at the rock. If we moved ahead under our protective fire support, the Japanese pinned us down and inflicted serious losses on us because it was almost impossible to dig a protective foxhole in the rock. No individual events of the attack stuck in my mind, just the severe fire from our left and the feeling that any time the Japanese decided to do so, they could have blown us sky high. Our attack was called off late in the afternoon, and we were ordered to set up our mortar for the night. An NCO came by and told me to go with him and about four others from other platoons to unload the Amtrak, bringing up supplies for Company K. We arrived at the destination place, dispersed a little so as to not draw fire, and waited for the Amtrak. In a few minutes, it came clanking up in a swirl of white dust.
"You guys from K Company, 5th Marines?" asked the driver. "Yeah. You got chow and ammo for us?" asked our NCO. "Yeah, sure have. Got a unit of fire, water, and rations. Better get it unloaded as soon as you can, or we'll draw fire," the driver said as his machine lurched to a halt and he climbed down. The tractor was an older model, such as I had landed from on D-Day. It didn't have a drop tailgate, so we climbed aboard and hefted the heavy ammo boxes over the side and down onto the deck. "Let's go, boys," our NCO said, as he and a couple of us climbed onto the tractor. I saw him gaze in amazement down into the cargo area of the tractor. At the bottom, wedged under a pile of ammo boxes, we saw one of those infernal 55-gallon oil drums of water. Filled, they weighed several hundred pounds. Our NCO rested his arms on his side of the tractor and remarked in an exasperated tone, "It took a bloody genius of a supply officer to do that. How in the hell are we supposed to get that drum out of there?" "I don't know," said the driver. "I just bring it up." We cursed and began unloading the ammo as fast as possible. We had expected the water to be in several 5-gallon cans, each of which weighed a little more than 40 pounds. We worked as rapidly as possible. But then, we heard that inevitable and deadly whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Three big mortar shells exploded, one after the other, not far from us.
"Uh-oh, the stuff's hit the fan now," groaned one of my buddies.
"Bear a hand, you guys, on the double," said the NCO. "Look, you guys, I'm going to have to get this tractor the hell out of here. If it gets knocked out and it's my fault, the lieutenant will have my cane in a crack," groaned the driver.
We had no gripe with the driver, and we didn't blame him. The Amtrak drivers on Peleliu were praised by everyone for doing such a fine job. Their bravery and sense of responsibility were above question. We worked like beavers, as our NCO said to him, "I'm sorry, old buddy, but if we don't get these supplies unloaded, it's our ass." More mortar shells fell out to one side, and the fragments swished through the air. It was apparent that the Japanese mortar crew was trying to bracket us, but was afraid to fire too much for fear of being seen by our observers. We sweated and panted to get the ammo unloaded. We unloaded the water drum with a rope sling.
"You fellows need any help?" asked a Marine who appeared from the rear.
We hadn't noticed him before he spoke. He wore green dungarees, leggings, and a cloth-covered helmet like ourselves, and carried a .45 caliber automatic pistol like any mortar gunner, machine gunner, or one of our officers. Of course, He wore no rank insignia, being in combat. What astonished us was that he looked to be more than 50 years old and wore glasses, a rarity. For example, only two men in Company K wore them. When he took off his helmet to mop his brow, we saw his gray hair. Most men forward of division and regimental CPs were in their late teens or early 20s. Many officers were in their mid-20s. When asked who he was and what unit he was in, he replied, "Captain Paul Douglas. I was division adjutant until that barrage hit the 5th Marine CP yesterday. Then I was assigned as R1, personnel officer, in the 5th Regiment. I am very proud to be with the 5th Marines," he said. "Gosh, Captain, you don't have to be up here at all, do you?" asked one of our detail in disbelief as he passed ammo boxes to the fatherly officer. "No," Douglas said, "but I always want to know how you boys up here are making out and wanted to help if I can. What company are you fellas from?" "From K Company, sir," I answered. His face lit up, and he said, "Ah, you're Andy Haldane's company." We asked Douglas if he knew Ack-Ack. He said yes, that they were old friends. As we finished unloading, we all agreed that there wasn't a finer company commander than Captain Haldane. A couple more mortar shells crashed nearby. Our luck would run out soon. Japanese gunners usually got right on target, so we yelled, "Shove off!" to the driver. He waved and clanked away in his unloaded Amtrak. Captain Douglas helped us stack some of the ammo and told us we had better disperse. I heard a buddy ask, "What's that crazy old gray-headed guy doing up here if he could be back at regiment?" Our NCO growled, "Shut up! Knock it off, you eight-ball! He's trying to help knuckleheads like you, and he's a damn good man." Each man in our detail took up a load of supplies, bade Captain Douglas so long, and started back to the company lines. Other men went back to bring up the rest of the supplies before dark. We ate chow and finished preparations for the night. That was the first night on Peleliu that I was able to make a cup of hot bouillon from my dehydrated tablets in my K-rations and a canteen cup of heated, polluted, oily water. Hot as the weather was, it was the most nourishing and refreshing food I had eaten in 3 days. The next day, we got fresh water. It was a great relief after that polluted stuff. Dug in next to our gun pit were 1st Lieutenant Edward A. Hillbilly Jones, Company K's machine gun platoon leader, and Assaulty Sergeant John A. Teskovich. Things were quiet in our area, except for our artillery's harassing fire pouring over. So after dark obscured us from Japanese observers, the two of them slipped over and sat at the edge of our gun pit. We shared rations and talked. The conversation turned out to be one of the most memorable of my life. Hillbilly was second only to Ack-Ack in popularity among the enlisted men in Company K. He was a clean-cut, handsome, light-complexioned man, not large, but well-built. Hillbilly told me he had been an enlisted man for several pre-war years, had gone to the Pacific with the company, and had been commissioned following Guadalcanal. He didn't say why he was made an officer, but the word among the men was that he had been outstanding on Guadalcanal. It was a widespread joke among men in the ranks during the war that an officer was made an officer and a gentleman by an act of Congress when he was commissioned. An act of Congress may have made Hillbilly an officer, but he was born a gentleman. No matter how filthy and dirty everyone was on the battlefield, Hillbilly's face always had a clean, fresh appearance. He was physically tough and hard and obviously morally strong. He sweated as much as any man, but somehow seemed to stand above our foul and repulsive living conditions in the field. Hillbilly had a quiet and pleasant voice, even in command. His accent was soft, more that of the Deep South, which was familiar to me, than that of the Hill Country. Between this man and all the Marines I knew, there existed a deep, mutual respect and a warm friendliness. He had that rare ability to be friendly, yet not familiar with enlisted men. He possessed a unique combination of those qualities of bravery, leadership, ability, integrity, dignity, straightforwardness, and compassion. The only other officer I ever knew who was his equal in all these qualities was Captain Haldane. That night, Hillbilly talked about his boyhood and his home in West Virginia. He asked me about mine. He also talked about his pre-war years in the Marine Corps. Later, I remembered little of what he said, but the quiet way he talked calmed me. He was optimistic about the battle in progress and seemed to understand and appreciate all my fears and apprehensions. I confided in him that many times I had been so terrified that I felt ashamed, and that some men didn't seem to be so afraid. He scoffed at my mention of being ashamed. He said that my fear had been no greater than anyone else's, but that I was just honest enough to admit its magnitude. He told me that he was afraid too, and that the first battle was the hardest, because a man didn't know what to expect. Fear dwelled in everyone, Hillbilly said. Courage meant overcoming fear and doing one's duty in the presence of danger, not being unafraid. The conversation with Hillbilly reassured me. When the sergeant came over and joined in after getting coffee, I felt almost lighthearted. As conversation trailed off, we sipped our Joe in silence. Suddenly, I heard a loud voice say clearly and distinctly, "You will survive the war." I looked first at Hillbilly, and then at the sergeant. Each returned my glance with a quizzical expression on his face in the gathering darkness. Obviously, they hadn't said anything. Did you all hear that? I asked. Hear what? They both inquired. Someone said something, I said. I didn't hear anything. How about you? Said Hillbilly, turning to the sergeant. No, just that machine gun off to the left. Shortly, the word was passed to get settled for the night. Hillbilly and the sergeant crawled back to their hole as Snafu returned to the gun pit. Like most persons, I had always been skeptical about people seeing visions and hearing voices, so I didn't mention my experience to anyone. But I believed God spoke to me that night on that Peleliu battlefield, and I resolved to make my life amount to something after the war. That night, the third since landing, as I settled back in the gun pit, I realized I needed a bath. In short, I stunk. My mouth felt, as the saying went, like I had gremlins walking around in it with muddy boots on. Short as it was, my hair was matted with dust and rifle oil. My scalp itched, and my stubble beard was becoming an increasing source of irritation in the heat. Drinking water was far too precious in those early days to use in brushing one's teeth or in shaving, even if the opportunity had arisen. The personal bodily filth imposed upon the combat infantrymen by living conditions on the battlefield was difficult for me to tolerate. It bothered almost everyone I knew. Even the hardiest Marine typically kept his rifle and his person clean. His language and his mind might need a good bit of cleaning up, but not his weapon, his uniform, or his person. We had this philosophy drilled into us in boot camp, and many times at Camp Elliott, I had to pass personal inspection, to the point of clean fingernails, before being passed as fit to go on liberty. To be anything less than neat and sharp was considered a negative reflection on the Marine Corps, and wasn't tolerated. It was tradition and folklore of the 1st Marine Division that the troops routinely referred to themselves when in the field as the raggedy-ass Marines. The emphasis during maneuvers and field problems was on combat readiness. Once back in camp, however, no matter where in the boondocks it was situated, the troops cleaned up before anything else. In combat, cleanliness for the infantrymen was all but impossible. Our filth added to our general misery. Fear and filth went hand in hand. It has always puzzled me that this important factor in our daily lives has received so little attention from historians and often is omitted from otherwise excellent personal memoirs by infantrymen. It is, of course, a vile subject, but it was as important to us then as being wet or dry, hot or cold, in the shade or exposed to the blistering sun, hungry, tired, or sick.
Early the next morning, 18 September, our artillery and 81mm mortars shelled Japanese positions to our front as we prepared to continue the previous day's attack northward on the eastern side of Bloody Nose Ridge. A typical pattern of attack in our company, or any other rifle company, went something like this. Our two mortars would fire on certain targets, or areas known or thought to harbor the enemy. Our light machine gun squads fired on areas in front of the rifle platoons they were attached to support. Then, two of the three rifle platoons moved out in dispersed order. The remaining platoon was held in company reserve. Just before the riflemen moved out, we ceased fire with the mortars. The machine guns stopped also, unless they were situated where they could fire over the heads of the advancing riflemen. The latter moved out at a walk to conserve energy. If they received enemy fire, they moved from place to place in short rushes. Thus, they advanced until they reached the objective. The mortars stood by to fire if the riflemen ran into strong opposition, and the machine gun squads moved forward to add their fire support. The riflemen were the spearhead of any attack. Consequently, they caught more hell than anybody else. The machine gunners had a tough job, because the Japanese concentrated on trying to knock them out. The flamethrower gunner had it rough, and so did the rocket launcher gunners and the demolitions men. The 60mm mortarmen caught it from Japanese counter-battery fire of mortars and artillery, snipers, who were numerous, and bypassed Japanese machine guns, which were common. The tankers caught hell from mortar and artillery fire and mines, but it was always the riflemen who had the worst job. The rest of us only supported them.
Marine Corps tactics called for bypassing single snipers or machine guns in order to keep forward momentum. Bypassed Japanese were knocked out by a platoon or company of infantry in reserve. Thus, mortars fired furiously on the enemy to the front, while a small battle raged behind between bypassed, entrenched Japanese and Marines in reserve. These Japanese frequently fired from the rear, pinning down the advance and causing casualties. Troops had to be well disciplined to function this way, and leadership had to be the best to coordinate things under such chaotic conditions. Marine tactics resembled those developed by the Germans under General Erich Ludendorff, which proved so successful against the Allies in the spring of 1918.
If the riflemen hit heavy opposition, our 81mm mortars, artillery, tanks, ships, and planes were called on for support. These tactics worked well on Peleliu until the Marines hit the mutually supporting complex of caves and pillboxes in the maze of coral ridges. As heavy casualties mounted, the reserve rifle platoon, mortarmen, company officers, and anybody else available acted as stretcher bearers to get the wounded out from under fire as fast as possible. Every man in Company K, no matter what his rank or job, did duty as a rifleman and stretcher bearer on numerous occasions on Peleliu and later on Okinawa. Shelling from the ridge positions on our left slowed us down. Our planes made airstrikes, and our ships and artillery attacked the ridges. But Japanese shells kept coming in. The company had an increasing number of casualties. We moved our mortar several times to avoid the shelling, but the Japanese artillery and mortar fire got so heavy and caused such losses to the battalion that our attack was finally called off about noon. On our right, 2-5 made better progress. That battalion moved forward through thick jungle, shielded from enemy observers, then turned east and moved out onto the smaller prong of Peleliu's Lobster Claw. We moved behind 2-5 eastward across the Causeway Road to exploit their gain. Again, shielded by thick woods, we moved away from Bloody Nose. We pitied the 1st Marines attacking the ridges. They were suffering heavy casualties. "The word is the 1st Marines catching hell," said Snafu. "Poor guys, I pity him," said another man. "Yeah, me too. But I hope like hell they take the damn ridge, and we don't have to go up there," said another. "That shelling coming from up there was hell, and you couldn't even locate the guns with field glasses," added someone else.
From what we had seen thrown at us from the left flank during the past 2 days, and what I saw of the ridges then, I felt sure that sooner or later, every battalion of every regiment in the division would get thrown against Bloody Nose. I was right.